decade ago, we were already starting to talk about this as the defining civil rights movement of my generation. And I realized I'd been a political reporter through most of it, and I had no idea how this subject, this topic, had sort of emerged as such a contentious issue in our politics, literally like where it came from, how it became a national issue, and how the country sort of, you know, moved towards consensus so quickly about it. And it seemed like, you know, we were getting to the point where you could start to look back at the whole arc of this and tell a big story about generational change and how it happens in this country.
And of course, it was such slow change, then things progressed pretty quickly. And Iowa was one of those first states in the nation, actually, to legalize same-sex marriage through a state Supreme Court ruling. And that was something that you also mentioned in the book. So Iowa has a role in this whole evolution over the last 25 years or more.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Varnum decision in Iowa in 2009 is really important for a number of reasons. I mean, obviously in the lives of not just couples in Iowa who wanted to get married as soon as it became legalized in the state, but gays and lesbians who could now aspire to build families on the same terms as everyone else. But from a national perspective, Iowa was the first state, you know, not on the coasts, to legalize same-sex marriage. I think it was a big shock for people who had seen Massachusetts, California, Connecticut legalize marriage, had seen successful movements towards it in other states. I think that was a just nationally pretty bracing for people to see that the Iowa Supreme Court had ruled that the fundamental right to marriage could extend to same-sex couples. I think it was a real early indication of the reach that this issue would have. And then one thing that happened in Iowa that was, you know, something of a model for other parts of the country was what didn't happen, which is the Supreme Court rules and politicians stay out of it. The legislature, the governor just sort of let the opinion stand. And it became a model for how activists can navigate both the courts and the political sphere simultaneously.
But then there was the backlash when they did the recall election. And the three different justices who voted in favor, they were voted out of office or out of their position.
Yeah. I interviewed Marsha Ternus in Des Moines, who had been the chief justice of the Supreme Court and had been in the majority in that opinion. And, you know, and she told me that she'd been up for retention elections in previous years and had never actually realized that she was on the ballot, that it was just, you know, so pro forma. And, you know, it was a show of strength at that time for the National Organization for Marriage and some local activists to defeat the judges who had been responsible for that decision. But it was also something of a Pyrrhic victory, which is they hoped that by claiming, you know, these scalps, basically, that they would sort of send an example to judges and politicians around the country that they could go too far by legalizing same-sex marriage. And very clearly, that was not a message that it was received. You started to have steer the New York. New York became the first large state to legalize same-sex marriage through the political process. And then obviously we see a whole bunch of federal court and state court judges around the country who are ready to rule in favor of marriage equality. They clearly were not daunted by what had happened in Iowa in 2010.
What's kind of interesting is one of those six original couples, they're from Sioux City. 10 years after that ruling, the couple ended up divorced. So, you know, all couples face issues when it comes to marriage.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things we started to see. The first legal same-sex marriages in the United States were in Massachusetts in 2004. And opponents had these almost apocalyptic predictions. It's going to be the end of the American family. It's going to be the end of Western civilization. And what happens afterwards is they stop being able to say that because even the sort of most aggressive critics of same-sex marriage can't point to anything terribly significant that changes in society. And one of the things people are looking at very closely in Massachusetts in the years afterwards is, are gay and lesbian couples who get married divorcing at a higher rate? And they don't. They start to act just like every other couple. And that means that, you know, a large portion of them are you know, 50% of American marriages end in divorce. And, you know, I think what's notable now, 6 years after the Supreme Court has ruled, is just how sort of fully integrated into the American family quilt gay and lesbian couples have been. And, you know, the sort of routineness of of divorces, you know, the couple that led the Massachusetts suit ended up divorcing. You know, that this is what happens to marriage in America in the 21st century. You fight really hard to win it as a civil rights cause, and then odds are 1 in 2 that you get divorced.
No, that's true. And, you know, your book, it's getting a lot of great press, many great reviews. New York Times called it one of the most anticipated titles of June. It arrived for Pride Month. And I'm going to maybe take you on a little tangent here. But what I find interesting about Pride Month, we've interviewed many people over the last month. And several of our local activists, they believe, you know, it's become way too commercialized. Now, you know, gay marriage has become mainstream, and now it looks like, you know, many different businesses now are kind of jumping on, you know, trying to maybe make some money off of that.
Yeah. You know, I mean, look, we saw the first time that pollsters started regularly asking about this issue in the mid-1990s, 27% of Americans supported same-sex marriage. Gallup this month showed 70%. That's just an astronomical shift. And a large part of that is straight people realizing that they have friends and neighbors and coworkers and family members who are gay or lesbian. I think it also is companies and, you know, realizing that they have gay employees and gay customers and, you know, by extension, you know, universities realizing that they have gay students and gay faculty, and the gays are, you know, gays and lesbians are an important constituency wherever you go in the United States now. And so, it is, you know, I think it's sort of inevitable that companies would see the value of them as a market. But also, I think one of the really important things that was a driver in this debate was companies realizing that for their employees, local marriage laws matter, because, you know, we saw a couple of anti-gay rights bills that moved through the legislatures in Arkansas and Indiana in recent years. And the biggest organizations lobbying against those new bills were Eli Lilly in Indianapolis and Walmart in Little Rock, because they recognize that they're competing for talents internationally, nationally, and that they're going to have trouble bringing people to come work in their cities from New York or San Francisco or LA or Miami or Chicago or wherever if they think that their rights are jeopardized. And I suspect we will see, you know, in Iowa, that companies that you don't necessarily think of as on the cutting edge of you know, liberal thinking on sexual politics are going to be big players in these issues as they play out in the political sphere, because they're going to realize how difficult it will be to compete for talent if people see the state as unwelcoming.
Well, you mentioned Iowa. I'm going to take you back to when I first met you during the Iowa caucuses. It was at a Pete Buttigieg event at the Orpheum Theater. You are a longtime political reporter and expert. Now, we know what happened, unfortunately, with the Iowa caucuses. We're going to talk about politics just shortly. What do you think there's a future for the Iowa caucuses? I know Nevada is making a run, or did make a run to be the first in the nation. What are your thoughts?
I mean, I think that there are sort of two separate questions. Like, one is there a future for caucuses? And I think that it's going to be very difficult for the Democratic Party to have, you know, party-run votes that are structured the way that Iowa's caucuses have been since 1972, where people are voting in public at a set time and place, where you don't have a secret ballot, where you don't have traditional counting or recounting mechanisms. Then the other thing is, like, what about Iowa? And I think what Nevada Democrats calculate, and Harry Reid was the driver of this there, is we still want to have a place early in this process, and we are willing to trade away the uniqueness of the caucus structure to stay early. And the question is, will Iowa Democrats, who have relied on the caucus as a fundraiser, as a source of party organization, as a way of getting their party leadership involved throughout the year, would they be willing to give up on the caucuses if it meant staying early in the nominating process?
No, that's interesting. And, you know, you've written so many different books. You did have one about the science of political campaigns, the sushi economy, this one, of course, on the 25-year struggle over same-sex marriage. What is next for you, Sasha? You had to be super busy. You also, I believe, you teach as well. So how do you do it all?
I take naps in the middle of the day. I do teach at UCLA in the political science department, and I love writing books, and I've been interested in a historic election fraud scandal that took place in Terre Haute, Indiana, a little over 100 years ago, that I think is both a great story and informs some of our current discussions about election fraud and such. And so I'm hoping to make that my next book project.
I have one more question for you. I know early in your career, you also contributed to a magazine that was called George, and it was founded by John F. Kennedy Jr. I loved and enjoyed that magazine. What was it like working for that publication, Sasha?
It was great. You know, so I was there at it was the first magazine I ever worked for. So I didn't have a whole lot of points of comparison then. And I was there from the, you know, before the launch. And so some part of what made it special was that startup magazines are sort of, you know, loose and in all sorts of ways. But, you know, the thing about John Kennedy that was really remarkable to me as a young journalist and has really stayed with me, you know, throughout my career is this was a guy who had never worked in journalism before, obviously had a sort of tremendous opportunity based on who he was to start a high profile magazine without any background in the area. But I just remember being in story idea meetings and such where he'd be surrounded by, you know, a bunch of career magazine editors, and he would have the sort of sharpest framing of a story. It was all instinct for him, and it was a sign that he was just a naturally curious guy, and it was, you know, part of why I never went to journalism school, and, you know, was seeing, like, wow, the best tools to be a journalist and to be an editor are to be curious, and that you either sort of pick it up or you don't. And that was something I learned most acutely from him early in my career.
No, I think curiosity is number one for sure. And listening helps too sometimes, which I don't always do.
Yes.
But no, Sasha, thank you. Is there anything else you would like our listeners to know at all?
No, I've enjoyed it. And hope I'm back in your part of the country soon.